welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Gwen Creedy. Gwen Creedy is a Rita Award-winning author of four romance novels. She has a BA in English Literature, as well as an MBA in Marketing from the University of Chicago. She lives in Pittsburgh, where all her books are set, and is hard at work on book number five. She's going to be reading from a couple of her novels this evening, and in particular, her latest book, Aching for Always. Welcome to Prosody, Gwen.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
How about you start out tonight with you reading a little bit?
I'd love to do that. The first thing I'm going to read is from my last book, Flirting with Forever. And it's the story of a woman named Cam, who's the curator of art at the Carnegie Museum of Art here in Pittsburgh. She's very eager to be promoted in her job. To do that, she knows she needs to get published. And she's sold her publisher on the idea of a biography of Van Dyck, but she hasn't written very much of it yet. And her publisher really wants her to sex it up so that it'll be more popular, you know, in commercial fiction. So she's kind of pondering how she can do that. Jacket is her former boyfriend. He's an artist who does reapings, which are portraits of people done in collections of fruit and objects that have been encased in lucite. And Jean is her administrative assistant, who's also very eager for her to get promoted because she'll get promoted too. So, all right. So Cam is looking at a painting on the computer. Because she's looking for a book. Cam didn't recognize the painting, which didn't surprise her, though she certainly recognized the artist. It was a Peter Lely, a minor painter of the late 17th century. Interestingly, the successor to Van Dyck as royal portraitist, whom the professors in grad school had only touched on. She had to admit, though, the painting, what she could see of it, was exquisite. Like Van Dyck, Lely had a way of rendering fabric that made it practically jump off the canvas. But there was something else about Lely that stuck in her head. What was it? Something that made him a bit out of the ordinary in the art world. She went to the bookcase and scanned the volumes of art books, looking for the exhibit catalog. And there it was. It had been in the office when she moved in. Painted Ladies, Women at the Court of Charles II. She pulled the book off the shelf and instantly gasped. On the cover was a portrait by Lely. She recognized it now, had seen the original at the Yale Center for British Art a few years back. The young woman, a courtier of some sort, face framed in light auburn ringlets, gazed at Lely with a look of relaxed and bemused understanding, as if she had shared her innermost secrets with him and knew they would be safe. Her frock, if one could call it that, was rendered in a stunning pumpkin silk that draped in gleaming folds so realistic Cam could almost hear the rustle. In the woman's left hand was a pale peony, open and tinged with pink. She held it toward the viewer, but the most eye-catching part of the portrait was the porcelain white breast, curving upward to a firm rose nipple that sat unashamedly above the neckline of the silk. Cam put her hand to her cheek. Wow. Taken as a whole, the portrait packed a heck of a punch. A woman of the court, whose hair, makeup, and clothes suggested a position of wealth and importance, yet who gazed upon her portraitist with unveiled sensuality, and who, more important, let her portraitist gaze upon her in dishabille. Even in the licentious court of Charles II, this would have excited the attention of viewers. Heck, Cam's own belly was tingling. And yet the portrait was not pornographic or leering in any way. It was a masterfully executed study of classical beauty. The proportions of the woman's face, the gleam of her skin, the delicacy of the blossom, the living, moving silk. But it was something beyond mere craft that provoked Cam's admiration. It was the trust the artist had built with his subject and the obvious appreciation with which he had portrayed the woman's assurance. Cam found herself wondering with some intensity what sort of man was capable of seeing a woman like that. "Look at this," she said, turning the book toward Jean. Jean's head tilted slowly. "Wow. I told you, it's by Peter Lely. Was he her lover?" "I don't know," Cam said. "Maybe, probably. Look at the way she looks at him. I mean, geez, it looks like they just..." Jean nodded. "Uh-huh." Cam opened the book and began to page through it. "Holy moly, there's more." Jean squeezed in next to her. Lely's women didn't all have a breast on display, though a decent, indecent proportion of them did. But every one of them beheld their portraitist with the same worldly, self-assured, half-lidded gaze. Did he do all of them? Probably, Cam said. Painters, she knew, generally considered themselves the absolute center, not only of their own universe, but everyone else's as well. She had to admit, though, this was a little like thinking women's porn, being adored from across the room by a man, master at his art, who saw you, fat or thin, beautiful or plain, as the most stunning, empowered, attractive woman on earth. For a moment, neither woman said anything. Then Jean pulled her eyes away from the book and regarded Cam closely. So what's it like posing for a portrait? Cam flushed. How the heck would I know? Oh, I don't know, Jean said. Maybe because you lived with a guy who paints portraits for 4 years. I mean, even with your boobs laid out like oranges and lucite cages, it's got to be kind of flattering. Cam felt the pins of embarrassment prickle her face. Jacket's pieces had always been done without a model. He claimed they were amalgams of many women he had known, and he did them from memory. Thus, she had ended 4 roller coaster years of happiness, hot sex, and knockdown drag-out fights, with not so much as a sketch on a napkin to show that she had inspired anything in his work. No, she said, Jacket doesn't use models. His work isn't about people in particular. It's about both the objectification of subjects in art and the rising of the human spirit against it. She'd repeated that damn phrase so often in her life, she felt like she had it tattooed on her forehead. Really? Jean said. Uh-huh. Cam returned with the book to her desk. She flipped by 2 more pages, but the self-portrait that dominated the third made her stop. Where Rembrandt's self-portraits projected impishness and Van Dyck's a quiet self-confidence, Lely had chosen to portray himself as both knowing and seeking, as if his life's experiences had left him slightly adrift. His hair, luxurious and auburn, framed his face in loose curls that reached to his shoulders. A strong nose led to a pliant mouth with full lips that looked capable of both an easy smile and something more complicated. The gentlest curve of cheek hung by the corners of his mouth, a signal of middle age in an artist unafraid of such trivialities. The shadow of a late-day beard burnished his cheeks and chin, but it was his eyes that struck her the most. Dark and liquid, they were like Sierra Nevada porter on a warm summer's night, and the single dot of cream in the irises, a painter's trick she knew, but in Lele's capable hand a trick for which she willingly suspended disbelief, signaled such a potent mix of pain and joy it made her heart cramp. With an effort, Camp returned her gaze to the screen. Sex and Van Dyck, she reminded herself. You're here for sex and rivalry. She ran the mouse past the picture on the screen in Amazon to where the large look inside was perched, and when she did, a menu popped up. Front cover, back cover, table of contents, or surprise me. The choice was obvious. She let the cursor hover over the words and pursed her lips, saying a quiet prayer that the click she was about to make would deliver her directly into Van Dyck's bedchamber with a tale of sex, lies, and oil paint that could be knitted directly into her biography. Oh God, please surprise me. As she brought her finger down, Cam's gaze slipped to the cover of the Lele catalog in Jean's hand, wondering again what sort of man it took to earn such a bemused, smoky look from an obviously entranced subject. Click. A noise like a giant vacuum cleaner filled the room. So loud, Cam clapped her hands over her ears, and wind blew everything off her desk, flinging her purse like a rugby ball into her lap and her chair into the radiator behind her. It was like the blast of a jet plane, only Jean, who looked at her, horrified, didn't seem to be affected by it at all. Cam was on the verge of dropping to the floor for protection when the wind stopped, the room went black, and the edges of her laptop stretched out like arms to envelop her.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Gwen Creedy. So, Gwen, in your bio, it says you went to University of Chicago and got an English Lit BA and then an MBA an MBA at U of C as well. And how does that lead to being a romance novelist?
Well, it certainly didn't directly. I went with my MBA and I moved back to Pittsburgh, where I had been born, and got a job working in a pharmaceutical company in their marketing department, and worked there for 22 years before my first book came out.
And so what prompted you to start writing romance novels?
Well, it's an interesting story. My younger sister died very suddenly and without warning when she was 31 in 1997, and I wanted to do something to honor her memory. if I hadn't already had two kids, I would have, which is all I wanted, I would have had a kid, another kid, and named it after her. But I'd already had all the kids I wanted, and I thought I wanted to do something that I could kind of dedicate to her. So I thought that I would try and write a novel, and if I was ever lucky enough to get it published, I would dedicate it to her. And a mere 12 years later, my first book came out, and I dedicated it to my sister, Claire.
Well, that's great. That's but what exactly about this form, you know, was it that you just started writing a book and all of a sudden you realized that that was kind of the market it was going to go towards, obviously, or somebody who knows about marketing? Or, you know, were you kind of consciously saying, I want to kind of move in these channels?
I actually hadn't been a romance novel reader growing up. A voracious reader though. You know, I love mysteries and, you know, nonfiction. And I always loved when they had love stories within those stories. Mm-hmm. I think my love of love stories comes from movies though. I just adore romantic comedies, and I think I've seen all of them, whether they're good, bad, or otherwise, and drag my poor husband along. So, you know, I'm certainly not an expert on cinema in any way, shape, or form, but I think that the way I write love stories has been very much influenced by movies.
Okay. And I know at least this is in the – I remember being like, I don't know, probably 14 or 15 years old, and I was thinking, oh, I'm going to try to write a Harlequin romance. I think, you know, every young girl at some point goes, I can write one of those, and sending away for the specs on what you needed to do. And then really finding it's like, oh, this, you know, it's a little trickier than I thought it was. And so with your book and now that you're working on your fifth book, do you find – I guess the question I'm trying to get at is there used to be kind of a formula, as it were. There were things that you could and could not do. I'm sure one that's changed over the years. But does that still apply or not? I mean, and I'm not thinking so much coming from the editorial side, but maybe from the fans?
Oh, interesting question. Well, of course, since romance is genre-based, you know, you're kind of required to have a happy ending. We like to term it, we being romance novelists, an optimistic and emotionally satisfying ending, which doesn't mean it always has to end necessarily happily ever after, but it has to kind of be moving in that direction. But short of that, there's you can get to that happy ending any way you'd like. I mean, at its heart, it has to be the story of two people coming together, facing very challenging hurdles, but working through the hurdles to end up together. And but I don't get any rules from my publisher. The readers do push back. You know, if you in fact. It in Flirting with Forever, where I just read the excerpt from, the hero is Peter Lely, the artist that she's looking at. You probably could have guessed that, but he is an actual artist who really lived, and I was scolded quite severely by a fan who said, you're not supposed to put real people in romance novels. She was very disappointed. When she finished the book, she said, I went to the internet and looked up his self-portrait, and he is not nearly as attractive as you described him. but
poor guy. Maybe in his time period he was.
Yes, exactly. That's the way I like to think about it. But the woman who wrote, I mean, I'm very appreciative when people write to me, but she did say, that's not enough for me to stop reading your books, and I will still continue reading them.
Well, that's so good.
Yeah.
You don't want to lose a fan over art.
No, that would be bad.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Gwen Creedy. Gwen, will you read a little bit more?
Sure. This next excerpt is from my current book. The book, in fact, it just came out this week. It's called Aching for Always. And in it, we have Hugh Hawksmoor, who is a sea captain who comes from the past to present day in Pittsburgh. He is determined to retrieve a map that has kind of changed the future for him, and also to avenge his brother's death. He lands in a kind of an alleyway that's rarely used in downtown Pittsburgh, but really exists, Strawberry Way. And when he lands, in a shower of sparks from the Gulf tower beacon. He sees an abandoned tailor shop. There really is a tailor shop on that street. And he decides to make this his base of operations. So he goes in and begins to pretend that he's a tailor. The heroine in the story is Joss, and she is running a struggling map-making company that her mother had founded. She sees these sparks and goes down to investigate what is going on, but she passes out before she can really figure anything out. He ends up picking her up and kind of setting her safely against a wall. So he knows who she is. She's trying to figure out who he is, and she decides she's going to come back with her. She's engaged, and she's about to be married in a very simple wedding ceremony. In fact, she's not going to be wearing a dress. She's just going to be wearing kind of a knee-length skirt, which her friend teases her about. But she's decided she'll try and find out more by pretending she needs to go to the tailor to get her skirt altered. And so she's trying to find out more about him, and he's trying to keep her from finding out, but he knows who she is. So he says, "How many inches do you want to have it taken up?" "No inches," she thought. "The skirt was perfect, absolutely perfect." "A tenth of an inch," she said. Oh, God, what had she done? The non-working tailor would take her skirt. She'd never get it back. She'd be going to her wedding in a pair of Old Navy cargo pants. "A tenth of an inch," she repeated. "Yes." His brows went up. "I'm sure we can do it, but..." "But you really can't," she said, grabbing it back. "I understand. It's short notice." "It is?" "Oh, yes. The wedding's in less than a week. Next Tuesday, actually. And there's the bachelorette party tomorrow and the party for the family on Thursday. Way too much for me to even think that I'd have time to pick it up, let alone that you'd have time to do it." He retrieved the skirt from her hands gently. "We can do it, but I wonder if you should consider a different color. Pales, I believe, should be reserved for the bride." She pressed her lips together. "I am the bride." Something shifted in his eyes. Was it surprise? "You are the bride?" His eyes trailed down to her hand. For once, the ring felt like an embarrassment. She shoved her hand casually in her pocket. "I am." "Many felicitations." He made a quaint, old-fashioned bow. "A wedding skirt, then." He scratched his jawbone, obviously confused. All at once, a look of horror came over his face. "I beg your pardon. Is this meant to be an undergarment of some sort?" "No, it's not an undergarment," she said, annoyed. The skirt had cost her $300. "This is the dress, then," he said, "in its entirety." "Yes." His concern grew. "There's a top, too," she said. He laughed, and for the first time, Joss caught an unveiled glimpse of the man from the night before. "I," the green in his multicolored eyes turned light and frothy, "I had imagined there might be a top." His tone made Josh wonder whether he had also imagined the lack of a top, and bubbles of adolescent helium flooded her veins. "My hesitation," he said, "is with the outfit as a whole." Oh, boy. She hoped he wasn't another one of those mutton-sleeve, little bo-peep wedding dress pushers. Or, worse, a fan of architectural, this-will-be-out-of-date-before-you-finish-the-honeymoon type gowns. "Oh?" "I see you elsewise," he said. "Are you perhaps familiar with the goddess Nike?" Nike? Where on earth was this conversation going, she thought. She cocked her head and made the curvy symbol of Nike with her fingers. "As in swoosh," she said. He frowned. "Swoosh? You know, the little..." She pointed to her feet, but no spark of recognition appeared in his eyes. Maybe they didn't have Nike in England, she thought. "Never mind," she said. "What about Nike?" "Nike," he said, "the goddess, is oft depicted with wings spread in flight. She is the goddess of battle and victory. Aphrodite is more beautiful, but to a discerning eye, Nike is far more engaging, for she has the flush of exertion on her skin." His eyes met hers, and the helium bubbles rose to a simmer. "I was fortunate to be given the opportunity to visit the home of the Earl of Hartlett," he said. "My family was not wealthy, and such an excursion was rare indeed. The Earl had a beautiful hall of sculpture. One in particular caught my eye. I am not a connoisseur of the arts, having neither the time nor fortune to be so, but I am a man, and the image of that work has lingered with me." He drew a pad and pencil from below the shelf and began to sketch. "Her feet and arms were missing," he said, "which gives her a bit of the appearance of a prisoner, but oh, what a prisoner. Her head is high and her eyes determined. She is captured at the moment of flight, lifting like an angel from the earth. She wears a dress, a chiton, I believe it is called, that falls in graceful waves from her shoulders. His able pencil stroke showed a woman in a Grecian gown, one leg behind the other, as if she were running, the movement rendered in streams of fabric that sailed into the imagined wind behind her. And here, he went on, drawing a crossbody slash from each shoulder to the opposite side of the waist, was the harness by which the fabric was held. Joss stared in trance. It was both feminine and vaguely warrior-like. Nice. That, he said, meeting her eyes, is how I see you. Me? It seemed a wildly seductive thing to say, but there wasn't a trace of irony on his face. Have I offended you? He said. No, she said, not at all. It's just, I don't know, it doesn't really seem like me. Truly? He sounded surprised. I have only met you, of course, but there is a certain vitality that is unmistakable. Does not a generous portion of courage come with it? Cam's mouth dried. Come, he said, let me show you. Here? You have a gown? He laughed. I suppose you could call it that. He led Joss into the fitting room and removed her coat and nudged her onto a raised platform. The light in the room was soft and flattering, and unlike the unforgiving mirrors in most department store dressing rooms, the mirrors here, flecked with age, seemed to reflect back an almost idealized version of herself. Joss could imagine a lot of people plunging into something they shouldn't have in this room. He gazed at the bolts of fabric. I know I saw something. After some sorting, he said, here, and withdrew half a dozen rolls of silk. Two were in jewel tones, another in black, two in white, and one in a shimmery taupe. He held the white out for her inspection. The fabric slipped through her fingers like petals. Beautiful. Her eyes went immediately to the taupe. It was the color of café au lait, opulent and rich. Moreover, since black was out for a wedding and white was too sweet for Joss's taste, taupe was the only color choice, simple and elegant enough to suit her. I like this one, she said. He drew out a length of fabric. May I? She nodded, and he draped the expanse over her shoulder. She inhaled. It was beautiful, like something a Hollywood siren of the 30s would wear. She pictured Carol Lombard on Clark Gable's arm. Nice, she said. He was gazing thoughtfully at her reflection in the mirror. I should like to see you in the white. She shifted. I'm not sure. 'Tis a classical conceit, he said. Purity, of course, always appropriate in a bride, but also strength. He let the taupe fall, and maybe it was the way the silk ran over her skin, but she felt as if she'd been stripped bare. Her blouse and skirt could have been made of air. Suddenly, this seemed like a slightly dangerous activity for 10 in the morning. I'm a little thirsty. He smiled. Let me see what we can find.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Gwen Creedy. So when you're dealing with characters who are from different time periods, what are the things you have to watch out for? I mean, I was thinking about that. I'm thinking, okay, it would be very easy to try and, you know, even as I've written pieces that aren't set now, and I think even of 10 or 15 years ago, and I really have to go back and think, what are simple things like, was it a cell phone or was it a mobile phone back there? Like, what was the technologies, all that kind of stuff? How do you kind of work that through when you're writing across periods?
Well, my favorite way to write it is for the woman to go back in time. So this one is a little different because the man comes to present day. And when the woman goes back in time, I have made it a little easier for myself by pretty much always having her go back to the same time period. In the years when I was trying to get published, my first manuscript took me 6 years to write, and it was set in 1705. And I did a ton of research, so I know what the politics were, what the people were wearing, what weapons were like, you know, what ships were like. I know everything about that time period. That manuscript got me an agent, but it was never sold to a publisher. So when I wrote the next book and decided I would do time travel, I kind of didn't want to lose all the research that I'd done. So my heroes tend to live right around 1705. It's kind of a very magical time for me. And then when the hero comes to the future, that's you need to spend a lot of time as a writer trying to see things through the eyes of someone who'd never seen anything like that before. And he's quite taken with the skyscrapers in Pittsburgh.
No doubt.
Yeah. Because Strawberry Way leads right up to the USX Tower. And so he stands there and just kind of open mouth looking at, you know, this tower of glass that goes up into the sky. It's quite
sure. When we were emailing back and forth and prepping for the interview, you had said to me that you could make a case for how romance novels are actually feminist text. And so I want to ask you to do that.
Oh, well, when you think about it, the woman always ends up victorious at the end of each story. Not that anyone loses. That's the great part about a romance is that everyone wins. But, you know, women, heroines always get what they want. They work through hurdles. They get challenges and meet them. They're very empowered. And at the end of the novel, they reach what they want. And, you know, I don't know what could be more feminist than that.
Okay. I'm going to push back on you a little bit just for the sake of argument and just say that I agree with all of that. And I think, you know, I use the feminist word in its broadest definition. But I'm wondering about just a lot of the tension and therefore the conflict that's created in romance work has to do about flirtation, getting him to look at her body, her looking at his body. I mean, those are things that actually, people who are like kind of feminist critics and scholars, they really concentrate on the gaze a lot. And do you ever are you concerned about that at all when you're writing? Do you see it as a thing where you want to make sure that the female character is not too objectified?
Yes. I suppose it might happen in other people's romances, but my hero and heroine fall in love with what's on the inside. I mean, that excerpt that I read about Peter Lele seeing whoever he looks at, you know, fat or thin, beautiful or plain, that was kind of the message of that book, is that she's attracted to him because of the way he sees women, which is that they're all wonderful. But you said the gaze.
Mm-hmm.
And that's G-A-Z-E. Yes?
Correct.
Okay. The gaze is pretty wonderful. I don't know what to tell you. But I think it sees way beyond what's on the outside.
Yeah, great. Can you read one very short section?
Okay. So this would be the very first pages of Aching for Always.
Great.
Brand O'Malley, Map Company, boardroom in Pittsburgh. "What is it men see in maps?" Joss O'Malley asked fondly as she watched her friend's 4-year-old son Peter staring intently at the framed antique map from his not-quite-steady perch on top of the credenza. Diane Daltrey, the former chief financial officer of Brand O'Malley Map Company and Peter's mother, lifted her eyes for a moment from the quarterly cash flow statement over which she was poring. "Key to the past?" she offered. Joss thought of her own fascination. "Hints of the unknown?" "Does this have a skull island?" Peter said enthusiastically, scanning the hand-colored paper. "I want to fight Hook to the death." He growled and thrust his lightsaber in the direction of the conference table. Marty, the map tech, who had just unfolded himself from plugging in 2 laptop projectors, ducked to avoid being skewered. "Or perhaps something slightly less poetic," Di said. "Peter, please take the highlighter out of your mouth. Your little brother was playing with it." Peter, who had jumped off the credenza, sighed and, with a day-glow green pout, handed the marker to his toddler brother, coincidentally named Todd. Joss frowned. "Should we?" "Nah, not poisonous," Diane said without looking up. "Well, not too poisonous."
Thanks for coming to Prosody, Gwen.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Wednesday night at 7:30 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.